Welcome to the New Books Network.
Poland emerged from behind the Iron Curtain in the 1990s as one of the bright spots in the transformation from communism to capitalism. After early years of promise, however, the country swerved, along with a number of other East European countries, toward the right. The Law and Justice Party sought to strengthen the religious, that is, the Catholic, aspects of Polish life. And after leading the way to the post-communist future, the country took a sharp turn to the right under the Kaczynski brothers. Yet it has just elected a government headed by centrist Donald Tusk, former prime minister of Poland during 2007 to 2014, and then followed by a stint when he left Polish politics to become president of the European Council from 2014 to 2019. So what's happening in Poland? My name is John Torpy, and I'm director of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Welcome to International Horizons, a podcast of the Ralph Bunche Institute that brings scholarly and diplomatic expertise to bear on our understanding of a wide range of international issues. We're fortunate to have with us today Grzegorz Ekiert, who is Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Government at Harvard University, director of its Minda de Gunsberg Center for European Studies, and senior scholar at the Harvard Academy for International and Area Studies. At the Center for European Studies, he co-chairs the seminar on Democracy, Past, Present, Future. And his books include Ruling by Other Means, State Mobilized Movements, which was co-edited with Elizabeth Perry, and Yan Shaojun, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. Capitalism and Democracy in Central and Eastern Europe, Assessing the Legacy of Communist Rule, which was co-edited with Stephen Hansen and published by Cambridge University Press in 2003. The authored volume with Jan Kubik, Rebellious Civil Society, Popular Protests and Democratic Consolidation in Poland by the University of Michigan Press in 1999. And The State Against Society, Political Crises and Their Aftermath in East Central Europe, published by Princeton University Press in 1996. Thanks so much for joining us today, Grzegorz Ekiert.
Yeah, thank you, John. Thank you for this generous introduction. Thank you.
Sure. Great to have you. Great to see you after so many years. So perhaps you could begin by reminding some of us of Poland's early post-communist path. I described it as, you know, a kind of promising one. That's certainly my recollection, my understanding, but was regarded as a real bright spot, at least economically speaking, after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Is that an accurate recollection?
Yeah, I think it was definitely accurate. And I think Poland in those years of the ending of Cold War played a very important role in the region. I think an argument could be made that that the transformations which brought about the fall of communist regimes were really started in Poland in the late 1970s with then emergence of Solidarity Movement, with the struggles under martial law. Poland had a massive opposition movement, which sort of membership counted in millions. So it played a very important role in bringing down the communist regimes. With it was the first country which entered the negotiations with the communists about the transition. It was the first country which had a semi-free election in 1989, and it was the first country in the region which elected the first non-communist government since 1944. So I think in all respects, Poland played a pivotal role in changes in Eastern Europe. And to surprise of many, I think it had a incredibly successful transition to democracy and market economy. I think it was surprising because of the factors I mentioned a moment ago. Poland had a very strong trade unions, very strong political movements, which sort of, you know, experts are telling us are not exactly the best condition for a democratic transition. Polish economy was in terrible shape in the 1980s and in the turn of the around 1989 with hyperinflation and really serious issues on all economic fronts. So Poland was a very unlikely candidate for swift and successful transition. But that's what happened actually, right? So Polish economic reforms were very decisive and very successful. Polish democracy consolidated quite a remarkable way. And that first 10 years of transition, or maybe first 20 years of transition, were very successful. They ended up with Poland being admitted to the NATO and then to becoming a member of the European Union. From the economic point of view, I think Poland is quite an amazing success story. It has been one of the fastest growing economies in the world over the last three decades. Some economists argue that the last 30 years was the most successful period in economically in Polish history over the last several centuries. And the numbers support that view, right? So, the Polish GDP went up 300% during that period. The same applied to living standards and all the other economic indicators. And Poland was the first country in many years which made the transition from developing to developed economies. So several years ago it was finally ranked as developed market economy. In this context of a very successful transition and very dynamic economic growth, I have to mention that inequalities initially relatively high by European standards declined quite dramatically. When Kaczyński government took power in 2015, Polish inequalities were at the level of Germany and some other welfare states in Western Europe. Most of the population were incredibly happy with their living situation. I mean, there are public opinion polls which show that dramatically. So I think it was a big surprise to many that at that moment Poles decided to elect the government which promised to reverse many of those changes over the previous 20 years, was very suspicious of the European Union, and decided to really sort of launch the nationalist revolution in Poland. I think the following 8 years were incredibly difficult and frustrating, both for majority of Poles, but also for international partners of Poland and the European Union in particular.
Right. And I think let me interrupt for just a second and say that I appreciate that sort of account of the early part of the transition period, but 2015 certainly introduces a kind of rupture in that trajectory, I would say. And I wonder, you mentioned the importance of trade unions, and of course Solidarity was the leading force really starting in the late 1970s, but a certain amount of the Polish transition also had to do with the country's traditional embrace of Catholicism. And I sort of wonder, how did that play a role in the rise of the Kaczynskis, which you describe as, surprising, unexpected, et cetera. So there were always these two forces. I mean, not only trade unions, but trade unions, civil society on the one hand, and also the Catholic Church, the Pope at the time, were major players in that. So where does Catholicism fit into the story of the Polish transition?
Thinking about the Polish civil society, how it developed after 89, I think it we had this explosion of civil society at the beginning of the transformations, with hundreds of thousands of new NGOs being formed. This was the explosion of the liberal civil society. But in the meantime, those building blocks of the old civil society, the trade unions, the solidarity, started to decline quite dramatically. And in fact, the solidarity movement moved, in nationalist right-wing directions. So it was an ally of Law and Justice Party and one of the most important supporters of Law and Justice policies. Now, the church story is here, slightly a different dimension of transformation. So, the Polish church was suspicious of movement to democracy and market capitalism, to say the least, and try to play a political role in this, being sort of placing itself as an arbiter of changes, right? So not really becoming a side of transformation, but really an institution which overlooks political change. Poland never had a Catholic Christian Democratic Party after 89, which suggests that church was not really interested in becoming, a part of politics in a sort of normal democratic way, supporting one of the political parties in the political landscape. But really wanted to be something much more important, and I think we see the effort of the church over the first 20 years of transition to reap significant economic benefits from transformation. The property of church was returned in ways which sort of are not exactly transparent. The church was supported by consecutive governments in quite significant way, and social agenda of the church, including abortion and others, were really becoming a kind of a political set of issues very very important for the country. So the church was taking lots of benefits from transformation, but at the same time we see quite significant secularization of Polish society. So people are moving away from church, and I think especially when you look at the attendance of in masses, Sunday masses and other church holidays, fewer and fewer people participate, and fewer young people participate in this. So church was very much alarmed by those developments and was trying to fortify its position by really making a very strong alliance to Kaczyński political party and the nationalist bloc in the Polish parliament. The church also supported what I call the pillarized civil society. The Polish civil society is deeply divided, almost the same way the Polish political parties are divided. You have a significant liberal bloc within civil society with some professional organizations, with lots of NGOs of various kinds, lots of foundations supporting liberal values and causes. But on the other hand, you have very conservative pillar of civil society, which is mostly organized by Catholic Church and based on parishes, with completely different, you know, agenda. This pillar sort of cooperates with the radical nationalist movements, with, you know, some really unpleasant neo-fascist small groups, which you know, fortunately are not highly visible and influential, but nevertheless, they are there. You probably caught this latest scandal in the Polish parliament when one of the really deranged radical movements of a very strange party jumped at the lightning menorah event with you know. I think that's the story. The question now in Poland is whether the coalition of right-wing nationalist groups and the church has enough power to really control the Polish politics. And the good news, of course, coming from the last election, is that that alliance, while still very powerful, does not have a majority. Right. So I think, you know, the Polish election, the last Polish election, was the rare good news those days, with all the terrible things happening all over the world. And I think we are, you know, very lucky to see the new liberal government headed by Donald Tusk in power. You know, it was just accepted by the president of the country, and they had the oath of office, you know, 2 days ago.
Right. So,
Poland is back on democratic trajectory. I think it's important because the one more term of peace would mean the end of Polish democracy, really.
Right?
So it was the last moment when things can be reversed and the rule of law reestablished and relations with Europe rebuilt. So that's indeed a very lucky moment.
Right. Well, it was an unexpected turn of events, I think, right, that Tusk took over, and a good sign, as you say. And insofar as, you know, the right in contemporary Europe is exercised about, you know, its opposition to Brussels, it seems to me that Tusk is a particularly kind of representative figure for, you know, the orientation towards Europe. So I wonder what you would say about that and what you expect from him, you know, now that he's in office.
Well, I mean, you know, it was a big sigh of relief in Europe because Poland under Kaczyński and Hungary under Orban posed a really, you know, quite significant threat to the European Union. Although, you know, over the last several years, EU developed strategies of you know, trying to deal with this kind of you know, anti-liberal, anti-European threats, but because of the construction of the European Union, I think it was very difficult to deal with countries which are sort of violating all the fundamental values of the Union. You know, when founding fathers were sort of designing the EU. No one really believed for a moment that you know, the member of the European Union could go authoritarian. So they did not construct the mechanisms of what to do when something like that happens. And indeed, it happened with Hungary and to some extent with Poland. So I think, you know, the fact that Poland is back liberal and pro-European camp is a very good news for the EU. Now, you know, Hungary, as the best friend of Putin in Europe, can be really isolated and control hopefully better than in the past. You saw yesterday, of course, that that Hungary voted against financial aid from EU to Ukraine, and that's exactly is, you know, the kind of policies supporting, you know, Putin's aggression, which Hungary has been pursuing for a number of years. Now it is, you know, we are talking about Poland, but you know, let me say this: it is really surprising that the country which suffered so much from, you know, the Soviet Union, now, you know, is so firmly supporting Russian imperial ambitions. You know, Poland was, I mean, Hungary was the ally of Nazi Germany, of course, was then, you know, invited by the Soviet Union in the end of the war. A very brutal communist regime was imposed on it. And then, you know, the Hungarian Revolution in 56 was crushed by Soviet military invasion. So, you know, given that that history, I think it's really difficult to understand why the Hungarian government does the thing as it does.
Well, now, presumably the answer to that is that Orbán thinks it's good for him.
Well, right. I mean, you can have a lot of potential ideas about why he is so firmly supporting Putin. You know, he has a lot of very close economic relations with Russia. You know, many of the economic relations with Russia involve, you know, significant amount of corruption, as we know. So you know, there can be a lot of potential explanation for his behavior. But I think, you know, Hungary is firmly an authoritarian society now, and it poses a serious kind of challenge to the European Union and to NATO, as a matter of fact, right? Because being a democracy has been one of the fundamental conditions for EU membership. So I think that it's going to be a very important several years in which the EU, you know, have to developed a set of mechanisms to deal with that situation. But I think, you know, from that point of view, Polish change is very important one, although, you know, it's not going to be an easy one. So first of all, I think, you know, Poland as a big country with significant economic and political interest is not going to sort of, you know, completely enthusiastically embrace everything you know, European Union wants to do, right? So I think you know, Poland is very much concerned about the voting system, and even, you know, with people like Tusk and Sikorski at the helm, they will be, you know, trying to reconcile some interest of the mid-sized countries with you know, with the proposed changes in the voting system in the EU and so on and so on. So that's one you know, issue that perhaps those who have you know, hopes that Poland will be absolutely, you know, in line with all the ideas on the table, maybe a bit disappointed. But you know, this government is firmly in support of the EU and European integration. The disagreement is about details and, you know, the way how to do it in the best way and so on and so on. And then, you know, the domestic situation is going to be a difficult one, right? So, you know, this is actually, you know, intellectually fascinating issue, right? How do you clean up after the populist rule? You know, it is a different situation when you have the collapse of authoritarian regime and transition to democracy. And we know that, you know, the way to deal with the old regime is one of the most significant issues in those processes of democratization. And over the years, lots of various strategies have been developed how to do this, right? So, you know, all the transitional justice ideas about truth commissions, about lustration, and so on are there and were used in different countries. But, you know, the government which was in Poland was not authoritarian one and didn't do horrible things. You know, many of the authoritarian regimes routinely do. So it didn't jail political opponents, it didn't kill, you know, opposition activists and so on and so on. So, you know, the things centered on breaking the rule of law, breaking the constitution and so on, corruption scandals of various kinds and so on. They're very important, but not, you know, in the same league as, you know, what communists did or, you know, what some other authoritarian regime did. So the big question is, okay, so how do you clean after the regime? How do you restore the rule of law? And of course, you know, peace was very clever in taking advantage of political institutions and rules of the game, and fortified its position in many different ways, as to prevent, you know, the new government from you know, doing many things. So the president is still, you know, the card-carrying member of peace. Peace has, you know, really massive representation in the parliament with, you know...
Peace, just to be clear, peace is law and justice, right?
Right, peace. Yeah. That's the Polish
acronym, sorry.
Of the law and justice, right. And there are many institutions which are still controlled by peace, the most important of which is the Constitutional Tribunal. And I think the discussion on the Polish liberal side is now how can we clean after peace, and can we break some of the rules to be able to restore the rule of law. So some of the Polish legal scholars are saying, well, you know, if you want to restore the rule of law, you know, the wrong way is to do it by breaking law, right? But some others argue that this is an unusual situation and it requires action, which sometimes, you know, you need to, you know, break the rule of law and constitution in order to make sure that the constitution is firmly in place and really not and really able to structure, you know, the political system. So it's you know, very difficult situation, and peace, as we already know after the election, is going to fight and to subvert changes in all possible ways. You know, the fact that the government is in place almost 2 months after the election has been a part of the game, right? So president of the country, using, you know, the procedures, gave peace, you know, almost 2 months to do many things. So first of all, to clean the offices. There was a lot of shredding going on to destroy all kind of evidence of wrongdoing by peace government and officials and so on. It gave the party time to to come up with a program of how to defend what they gain over the years, and it gave the party possibility to change the laws to prevent the Tusk government from cleaning up, right?
Interesting. So, I mean, it sounds in a way not unlike our own situation, even stemming back to the Obama period, when there were calls for, trying or otherwise coming to terms, so to speak, with the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, and, that went nowhere because Obama thought, that's going to divide the country in ways that simply, the country can't withstand. And of course, we've now been through this with Donald Trump. And, tried to put him through, constitutionally mandated procedures for, wrongdoing in high office and that sort of thing. And he faces all these trials. But the problem with this is that it may create and seems, if you look at what's going on in the Republican Congress, it may create a kind of cycle of retribution. Every time a new party comes into power, they say, well, the previous guys did something bad and we have to, go after them about it. And then you start, having polities like, we associate with Central America and things like that. So anyway, it is a fascinating problem. I agree with you.
This is exactly the why this issue is so important, right? Do you want to establish that pattern that every time the new party takes over, this is this massive, firing going on and so on? But the one point which needs to be stressed in comparing, US and European countries is that the key difference is that the European governments have much more control over the economy, over various structures of local administration and so on, right? So, the cleaning after Trump involves his own, basically, and his closest associates, actions breaking the law and so on. Trump did not take over American television and turn it into a propaganda machine, right? Trump did not expel all the directors of theaters and museums and so on and put his own people there, right? So I think, it's on the one hand, given the proportional representation and multi-party systems in Europe, it's more difficult for extremists to take over power, right? Because, parties of that kind usually have like 20%, 25% at best votes in European countries. So it's much more difficult to form the majority government by the parties of radical right, but then when for whatever reason they are able to get power, they have much more opportunities to do the damage to the institutional system. So, another example, Poland has a relatively large state sector. The PiS government, the Kaczyński government, staffed the boards and managements of those companies with thousands of its own supporters and party members. Now, you have to clean it up because those people are usually people who have no skills and preparation to run this kind of enterprises. So imagine that a Polish energy company, one of the biggest in Europe, is run by a person who finished the high school for agriculture technicians, and his only accomplishment is that he was the mayor of a tiny city, like a big village in Poland. Now he is made, a manager of something which is like, Shell or BP, a huge company with assets and operations in many countries and so on. And that happened to many places in Polish institutional landscape. They, PiS absolutely reject meritocratic criteria, scrapped, all the exams and other requirements for officials, like, in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Under the liberal governments, you needed to know two languages and have education at certain level to become ambassador in the country. Now, PiS scrapped that, right? So you could become an ambassador without knowing any foreign language. And that kind of affected everything, from industries to, local administration and so on. So now, restoring the meritocratic criteria in filling up positions, in industry and government is one of the most important challenges which that government faces.
Right. Well, I wasn't really aware of the extent of the, loyalists, putting loyalists in positions of whatever authority. But, I've mentioned Trump. I'm sorry. I couldn't avoid it, I guess. But, this is exactly what people seem to think is what he's going to do if he gets in to office the second time around. He's precisely going to clean house, install his loyalists, get rid of, the so-called deep state. And, there was this striking confluence of media coverage of this, as you probably saw, articles in the New York Times, Robert Kagan's lengthy article about what Trump was going to do if he gets into power, and a special issue of The Atlantic all addressing this problem. And that strikes me as a high level of alarm, at least among, liberal media elites in the United States. And so I wonder, from the perspective of a place that's gone through this, what would you say about our situation? And, there's, of course, a corollary concern that if Trump gets into power, his, enthusiasm for NATO is distinctly limited. And, what might he do on the foreign policy front?
Well, I think, there are very important lessons for the U.S., from the situation like the one in Poland, but also in some other countries like Turkey, for example, right, where you have the leader with authoritarian ambitions. And of course, as we know from, wonderful book by my friends Daniel Ziblatt and Steve Levitsky, most of the ways in which, democracy operate are based on informal norms, which, actors are not forced to obey, right? So if someone rejects those informal norms and rules, situation changes in very dramatic way, right? So I think, what happened in Poland, the one important dimension of it was that for the first 25 years of transition, Poland was trying to build a public service. Basically, the professional bureaucracy, which is built on meritocratic criteria, which is not removable by a change of the ruling party, except for the top positions, right? So, this is what has been going on in the US as well, right? We have those professional bureaucracies, highly competent, and when the presidency changes hands, have new secretaries and assistant secretaries in those bureaucracies, but not really, professionals who are there. Now, we know that it's easy to change the rules of that kind, right? So I think, you know, in preparation for, you know, possible takeover of state bureaucracies, some, you know, things have to be fortified, right? I mean, yesterday you had the best example, right? So with this new defense appropriation, we have a law now on the books that the president cannot take U.S. out of NATO alone, yeah. Right? And that's kind of, you know, a good example of how you introduce the legal, you know, barriers for someone who, you know, wants to rule in a constrained way. So now, you know, Trump, if he gets the second term, will not be able to come to Europe and say, okay, I decided that US is going to leave the NATO. And I think, you know, that sort of, you know, legal preparation for, you know, potential authoritarian predilections of the president should be really seriously considered, because it's, you know, it's the moment you start taking over. I mean, you know, the big advantage, of course, in the US is that you know, you have free press in private hands. I mean, you know, you cannot change the heads of newspapers the way peace did it in Poland, right? So that's the big advantage. And of course, you know, the private sector, I mean, the industry, the economy is in private hands, right? So it's not easy to, you know, put your people in charge of big companies and so on. So, you know, US has much more leverage in dealing with someone with authoritarian ambition than many of the European countries where the governments have much more power. So that's, you know, but I think now we really need to consider, you know, seriously the fact that democracy is not safe in any place, you know, including, you know, the US, including, you know, big continental European countries and so on. So you know, knowing that that's the case, we have to think really seriously how to build fortifications which sort of will slow down or prevent, you know, political parties or presidents or prime minister with authoritarian ambitions to be able to implement those ambitions.
Well, I think we're going to end it there. Thank you for that fascinating and illuminating overview of the developments in Polish politics since 1989, basically, but also ending with a kind of warning for us as well, and a very worrisome kind of proposal, I think, for where we stand and where, you know, much of the world, in fact, stands, or parts of the world that we, you know, in some ways have taken for granted would never be authoritarian sorts of countries. But, you know, it's happening in Hungary and may happen elsewhere. But I just want to say thanks so much for, you know, to Grzegorz Ekiert for his insights about Polish and East European and our politics. I also want to thank Osvaldo Mina Aguilar for his technical assistance and to acknowledge Duncan McKay for letting us use his song International Horizons as the theme music for the show. This is John Torpy saying thanks for joining us, and we look forward to having you with us again for the next episode of International Horizons.